From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. It's a singular figure in American industry, not just the automotive field. Lee Iacocca died in Los Angeles yesterday at the age of 94. We open today's program looking back on Iacocca's legacy at Ford, the Mustang's success under his leadership, and his revitalization of Chrysler. We'll also look at facial recognition technology used by police. The Ford Mustang, a car that many Americans dreamed about and sold thousands of the vehicle over the years. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We begin today's program by remembering Lee Iacocca, who died yesterday in Bel Air here in Los Angeles at the age of 94. As you just heard on NPR News, Iacocca, a man who made quite a mark at Ford Motor Corporation before revitalizing Chrysler, which was moribund at the time. He used his personality, his sense of what Americans would want in cars to revitalize that company. A little bit later this hour on Air Talk, we'll take a look at facial recognition technology used by law enforcement and a state bill that would ban the use of facial recognition technology being used in conjunction with body cams worn by law enforcement officers. But with Lee Iacocca, one of the big aspects of his success as a businessman was his force of personality, which we hear in this television commercial from 1992.
It's no secret that foreign competitors have been giving American car makers a real beating. About 5 years ago, we decided enough is enough. This is where it stops. The first thing we did was take a good hard look at our own company. And if we found something that slowed things down or didn't add value or improve quality, we dumped it. Then we reorganized the whole place into four platform chains: large car, small car, truck, and minivan. We spent $1 billion on a new technology center. Now, this new way of doing business means we'll be putting our concepts in your garage while the competition is still sharpening their pencils. And if you want proof, we've got proof.
Man could seemingly sell anything. With us, Mark Phelan, Detroit Free Press auto critic and columnist. He's been covering the auto industry for 30 years. Mark, thank you for joining us. So we just got a little taste of the Iacocca touch there. What are his most important contributions to the industry?
Oh, well, it was wonderful hearing that voice being reminded just what an accomplished salesman he was. There are very few people in the whole history of the auto industry who were closely associated with one revolutionary vehicle, but he was there at the genesis and guided two of them, the Mustang and the Chrysler minivan, to incredibly different vehicles, but vehicles that change the nature of what Americans expect from cars, why we like cars. And he was there for both of them, 20 years apart. It showed that he was not one of those people who was just locked into a single narrow vision of what the customer wanted, but that, you know, he could see sometimes what customers would want when they had no idea themselves. No one had any idea what a minivan was, and Chrysler rolled this odd-looking little thing out in 1983, and, you know, within a few years, every family in the country was driving one because it was the perfect solution for families with young children. And that was what he understood. He could recognize a good idea, and he knew how to put the people who could execute a good idea in a room together and give them space and then tell America, this is what you've been waiting for.
Well, that opening commercial for the Mustang that we played, you know, the company, and I don't know how much Iacocca had to do with this or Henry Ford III, but, you know, they filmed that at the World's Fairgrounds in New York. The commercial ran simultaneously on all three networks at the time. There's a real sense of showmanship. And was it Iacocca who brought that to Ford?
Oh, very much so. He was one large part P.T. Barnum. He managed to get that commercial on both on all three of the major networks at a time when he also managed to get the Mustang on the cover of both Time and Newsweek on the same day, which you'd be lucky to do with a newly elected president, much less a new car. He was an absolute genius at marketing and at seeing ways to put his story in front of the greatest number of people.
We're talking with Detroit Free Press columnist and auto critic Mark Phelan, who's been covering the auto industry for 30 years, actually more than 30 years. Also with us, Bloomberg Detroit Bureau Chief David Welch, who interviewed Iacocca on a couple of occasions. David, good to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
So what stood out to you in your personal interactions with him?
Well, look, he was a brilliant guy, first of all. He was also very entertaining, and as some of the execs who worked with him over the years would say, he was also a flawed guy. I didn't quite find him that in person, but it was talking to Lee was almost like the Larry David character in Seinfeld of George Steinbrenner, who just was on these stream of thought rants. And look, even his PR guys would tell me, listen, when you're interviewing Lee, if you ask one question and let him go, he'll go off on this, you know, kind of stream of thought, just nonstop spiel. And you have to cut him off and don't feel bad about it, because he'll pick up your next question and run with it until you cut him off. It was that sort of conversation. But the insights were great. He was immensely quotable. And he was just, I think everybody liked interviewing Lee because he was one of the true characters of the industry at a time when we had really big personalities at these companies. And you don't see that quite so much anymore, with the exception maybe of Elon Musk at Tesla. You really don't have big personalities running the companies.
Well, and people with great sales skills, you know, sometimes can rub people the wrong way. And it seems like, despite the fact Iacocca might have done that with some of the people he worked with, certainly he had the falling out with Henry Ford III. But when it comes to the American public, my sense is that, you know, virtually everybody found Iacocca entertaining. And that's a tremendous skill.
It is. And look, to Mark Phelan's point, he was part P.T. Barnum, and the public certainly liked that part because, remember, this is the guy who said, if you can find a better car, buy it. And at the time, the cars they were making were not good quality. There were plenty of better cars on the market, but people liked the pitch. However, he also had a lot of credibility. And you know, this is the guy who went to the federal government and got the government to give loan guarantees, and Chrysler borrowed $1.2 billion, but it was backed by the U.S. government, and they did pay it back early. And, you know, in his typical way, he went out and said, we borrow money the old-fashioned way, we pay it back. But they, you know, America loved that kind of bravado, but it was true, too. They did pay it back early, and the federal government actually did pretty well on the investment, and Chrysler was saved. So it was a great line, but he also had real meat on the bones of the story, and he just had immense credibility, I think, for that reason. He also did with his employees. He was tremendously motivational internally. I interviewed Tom Stallkamp last night. Tom was in purchasing for Chrysler and eventually was president of the company, and he said he quit Ford when Ford was doing well and Chrysler was headed into its near bankruptcy experience, and his family actually thought that he had mental problems for leaving Ford to go to Chrysler. But he said that there was a big meeting we had in the atrium of the Mopar building. Mopar was their parts unit. Everyone was sitting on folding chairs on linoleum floor. And he just said, look, the government's going to help us, but we got to save this thing. We can't let this company go under. We have to do this. And everybody gave him a standing ovation, and people were just behind the guy. He really did know how to connect with people.
Let's talk about his background, because he was a child of the Depression. That obviously had a strong influence for people who lived through those traumatic events. Extremely competitive guys, we understand. Mark, let me go back to you for this, to talk about the formative experiences for him. And it seems like he was completely unabashed about how competitive he was and how driven he was.
Oh, absolutely. All of that. And he was first-generation American. His parents were, you know, Italian immigrants, and he wore that as a badge of honor, both the Italian heritage and the immigrant heritage. I mean, one of the things that is easy to forget, because it was not associated with a specific vehicle, was that in 1986, the 100th anniversary, I believe, of the Statue of Liberty, the Statue of Liberty was a wreck, and Ellis Island was virtually closed, and President Reagan put Iacocca in charge of a private group to fund the restoration of the two of them, and they did it, and we've got a couple of national treasures that are still today in the condition that that he was responsible for putting him in. So his father was a showman as well. His father had a natural marketing sense, but they lost, the family lost just about everything in the Great Depression, and I think that gave Iacocca some of the sense of urgency that he brought when he saw that Chrysler was about to go under, and it would have taken with it millions of families, thousands of small companies. It would have been a devastating effect on the whole economy and the kind of thing that he had lived through as a child. And I think that was part of what he brought with him to the job of saving the company. And he made a mint doing it for himself as well.
Back in the late 80s, there was talk about Iacocca perhaps running for president. And in a January 1987 Gallup poll of potential Democratic presidential candidates for the 88 election, Iacocca finished second with 14%. Only the Colorado Senator Gary Hart outpolled Iacocca. Now, you can say that's so early, that's just name recognition. But David Welch, that's still impressive that a guy known as a car executive and TV pitchman would have that kind of success in a Gallup poll.
A cult of personality around him that you see with few business executives. You do see it these days with Elon Musk. You had it certainly with Steve Jobs. Iacocca had it in a different way than both of them, but he really did have this straight talk. In fact, one of his books was, I think, called Talking Straight. He really did have this straight talking, no BS, not your typical government type of guy kind of personality. Big, kind of in your face, but believable. And that was very serious talk. People who were close to him say that a campaign probably would not have gone well because he didn't take too well to criticism, and he could be blustery. But he certainly had a lot of gravitas that I think would have made him a pretty credible candidate anyway.
David Welch, Bloomberg's Detroit bureau chief, with us. He interviewed Lee Iacocca on a couple of occasions. Mark Phelan, auto critic and columnist for the Detroit Free Press for more than three decades. He's covered the industry, and we're talking about the legacy of former Chrysler head Lee Iacocca, who jumped from Ford after having a huge influence on that car maker and totally revitalizing a financially moribund and design moribund Chrysler. His TV ads becoming part of popular culture, parodied on television. He's a talk show guest. He's a public figure, probably the highest profile car person since Henry Ford. And Ford's grandson was, in fact, the person with whom he worked at Ford. And Mark, what was the falling out about? Where in some ways was Iacocca almost too much like Ford the Third's grandfather?
You know, it is still one of the great mysteries of Detroit. Henry Ford II promoted Iacocca to president of Ford Motor Company, which at the time was one of the crown princes of American industry. And then a few years later, he called him in one day and said, "I think it's time for you to go." And there are still multiple stories about why it happened. At one point, Ford just, you know, said, "Sometimes you just don't like somebody." You know, at other times he said, you know, that he didn't think Iacocca, you know, was the right representative for the company. We still don't know what led to the parting of the ways. But it was at a time when Ford needed to be changed as well. Iacocca had been there for decades at the time, and the company had its own problems, although not as deep as Chrysler. And Iacocca left, and that allowed Chrysler to reach out within days of when he was fired and snag him, and he gave them the authority to go to Congress and say, "This company matters. If you give us the loan guarantees to get through this, we will repay you." And it worked.
So funny. I'd forgotten that in the early 21st century, Iacocca returned to the airwaves doing a Chrysler ad with Snoop Dogg. I'd forgotten all about that. So
it was so wonderful. I remember seeing him the day the shows were announced, and he had absolutely no idea who Snoop was. He knew a great commercial, and he knew that he was in another one of them that day.
All right. Hey, thanks so much. I appreciate it. Good to talk with you both about the legacy of Lee Iacocca. He died here in Los Angeles in Bel Air yesterday at the age of 94. He had Parkinson's, not clear what the specific cause of death was. My thanks to David Welch, Bloomberg's Detroit bureau chief, and Detroit Free Press columnist and auto critic Mark Phelan. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, we'll talk about the debate over whether facial recognition technology should be able to be employed using video that's captured on officers' body cameras. There's a bill in Sacramento which would ban the usage of facial recognition technology using that footage. We'll debate it coming up in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Congratulations to the U.S. women's soccer team with their big win yesterday, a close-fought, hard-fought game against England. And the final is coming up this weekend. On Friday, we'll be previewing the matchup, and we'll know by that point who the other finalist is against the U.S. women. We'll be off tomorrow for the Independence Day holiday. We have special programming for you, but back with you Friday. In addition to that preview of the Women's World Cup final, we'll also have Film Week for you coming up Friday at 11 here on 89.3 KPECC. Well, we previously talked on the program, at least I think we have, about the city of San Francisco's banning of the use of facial recognition tech by the San Francisco Police Department. Oakland has also considered that. But in Sacramento is something similar, a bill that would ban the use of facial recognition technology being applied to video captured by law enforcement officers' body cams. The concerns come largely from civil liberties advocates who say that the technology is a very blunt instrument which can falsely identify individuals, that there are problems with identification based on race and gender, and that it also enables the possibility of people being illegally tracked by law enforcement officers. With us to talk about the concerns, Legislative Director for the ACLU of California, Kevin Baker. Thank you, Kevin, for being with us again. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So let's start, first of all, with specifically body cams, because that's what this legislation is aimed at. Why is it a particular problem, as you see it, using facial recognition with the images captured, the video from the cameras?
Yes, that's right, Larry. The ACLU is part of a large coalition of many organizations dedicated to promoting civil rights and civil liberties that is supporting AB 1215 to prevent body cameras from being turned into a tool for surveillance. As your listeners will remember, body cameras were promised as a tool to ensure police transparency and accountability, not as a way to spy on people by allowing the government to identify us and track our movements. Of course, we want to ensure that everything is done to reduce and document unjustified police violence and strengthen police-community relations and improve public trust. That was the reason why body cameras were implemented, not as a system for mass surveillance. We're also concerned about some of the issues that you mentioned in terms of the accuracy of this technology. You can look at it both ways. There are serious problems with accuracy, but even a accurate system, a completely accurate system, would have another set of problems. The way these technology works is that it takes what is called a face print, a geometric image of your face that is a unique identifier for each of us, like DNA or fingerprints. But unlike DNA or fingerprints, it can be taken remotely without our knowledge and consent. And compared to this massive database that the FBI has recently acknowledged contains the images of over 640 million Americans. There are only, I think, about 330-odd million people in the country. So this database is indeed very large. So if you think that you haven't done anything wrong and therefore you should have nothing to worry about, you should know that you're nevertheless probably in this database that the police could be using to track your whereabouts if facial recognition is allowed on body cameras.
Well, could you not have legislation that would specifically ban the use of law enforcement tracking using facial recognition technology, but still be able to use the technology to help solve crime? So, in other words, you have the aftermath of a crime, you have video from an officer's body-worn camera, you can compare that to the database and for investigative purposes be able to connect it to potential perpetrators of the crime.
Well, I think the difficulty with that is that you'd have to have that system probably operating at all times, and therefore it's going to suck up a lot of images. People, I think, are naturally afraid because of the misidentification in this technology, particularly with respect to people of color and women. The technology is highly inaccurate. The ACLU did a study of this technology using images from members of Congress, and we compared those images to a mugshot database and identified 28 members of Congress who were incorrectly identified as people in that mugshot database, including Congress members Stephen Knight and Jimmy Gomez and Norma Torres in the Southern California area.
But we know eyewitness accounts are also notoriously inaccurate, but law enforcement doesn't refuse to talk with eyewitnesses because there's a good chance there'll be errors in the account. It's just sort of a place to start. So why is the fact that there's a high inaccuracy, why would that stop you from still including that as potential keys, the same way you talk with eyewitnesses that are fraud?
Well, I think that one of the dangers is that we want people to be free to call the police when they need help and to cooperate with the police when the police need assistance. That's very important to public safety. That's how crimes typically are solved. And if people fear that they are going to end up in this database as a result of their interaction with police, and who knows what becomes of that database, who it's shared with, whether it's immigration officials or other government agencies. I think it may very well deter people from participating with the police in a way that undermines public safety and doesn't improve it.
We're talking with the ACLU of California's legislative director, Kevin Baker. Also with us from the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, Lieutenant Derek Sabatini. Lieutenant, thank you for being with us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So your response to the idea that it would be difficult to just apply this technology fairly to investigations, you know, separate and apart from the potential for tracking people's whereabouts or activities. Do you disagree with that contention?
Yeah, I disagree. We've been using facial recognition in Los Angeles County since 2009, never had any issues with it. With court or any lawsuits or legal issues or actions from it. And in fact, ACLU has been in discussions with us for a couple years, at least one interview with them a couple years back. So it's for investigative purposes, and I agree with what you had stated earlier as far as there's the way this bill is written. It's written to include investigative and surveillance all in one. And I think it would be wise to separate the two because you would be limiting law enforcement from utilizing facial recognition off of body-worn cameras and could jeopardize public safety.
Are there significant numbers of cases that have, at least in part, been solved as a result of facial recognition technology applied to officer video?
Now, body-worn cameras are relatively new, so there's not a lot of data on them being video or images captured from creating investigative leads that led to an arrest. So I really don't have any data on the body-worn cameras. But if you use facial recognition generically and looking at images that have been captured from either CCTV or images brought from witnesses saying, hey, this is the individual at the crime scene, those, then yes, there has been. And I'll say facial recognition is not identification. And one of what Kevin had stated is that it inaccurately identified individuals. Facial recognition doesn't identify anybody. It is an investigative lead only. The only biometrics that identify anybody are fingers, iris, and DNA. So as you stated, Larry, earlier, that it takes the investigation to determine who your suspect is and to create probable cause to bring to the DA to present the case. You can't just use it. I think people watch too much TV and see, you know, on 24 or whatnot, and you get an image and you put it in a computer and 2 seconds out comes this person, and then they go grab them and arrest them for because their image got spit out in some fancy computer program. And that's not how it works.
How does it work then? So if you put in the image of an individual, how does it connect up with the database of photos of other people? What does it come up with a particular range, or how does it work?
So that's a great question. So in Los Angeles County, and it's all law enforcement agencies in Los Angeles County, they have the ability to utilize facial recognition off of our database of mugshots, and it's only mugshots. There are no driver's license, no DMV, no Facebook. There are no images that are outside the criminal booking photos of individuals that have been arrested prior. So if you get a probe image, and or that's an image that's captured in the field, whether it's, say, it's the bank cameras or the 7-Eleven camera, and you get a still image, it has to be a quality image that we can then put into the system and compare it to the database of booking photos, and then you'll get a candidate list. And the way that our software works, you get 250 individuals that are candidates, and with the highest number being first, and then as they get further and further, then they get less. So the investigator will then look at that candidate list and say, are any of these individuals potential matches? And then they conduct their investigation from that point.
Okay.
They give you any, this guy is your guy,
yeah,
the list of candidates.
So it's not like, as you said, what we see on TV. This bill specifically deals with video from body-worn cameras by officers and applying facial recognition technology. You're talking about, over the past decade, how the Sheriff's Department has successfully used facial recognition technology largely without the body cam video. So what's wrong with having a ban that is limited to body-worn cameras and using it there? This bill does not apply to the way that your department has been using it for the last 10 years. So what's wrong with making it very specific? You know, because of the very kind of public interactions Kevin Baker of the ACLU was talking about, where people might be fearful that their images are captured on police body cameras and then become part of the database.
Well, the video that was be captured would be video that's captured like a CCTV feed. It wouldn't be video that's captured. And if you want to make precautions and write laws and change the law to, like as you spoke earlier, to prevent them from tracking individuals, then, yeah, ban tracking on there. But what LAPD recently had and you might have seen it on TV, where they went in foot pursuit through a certain area, and an individual engaged and shot the officer, the second officer in the foot pursuit. Now, hypothetically speaking, if that was the only video that we had, that body-worn camera video of that shooting and that suspect, with this AB 1215, we would not be able to utilize that body-worn camera video and our facial recognition system to help us develop a lead to that investigation to identify that individual. And that's just one example. There's probably more and more examples as
more officers wear more cameras. Let me bring Kevin Baker of the ACLU of California back in. You want to respond to that, that there's an example with the LAPD and the shooting of an officer where you'd have potential more difficult investigation without having facial recognition technology you could apply there?
Yeah, well, as I understand it, this technology is not currently being used anywhere in California with respect to body cameras. So this is not actually a sort of a field operational kind of issue
It's anticipatory.
It's exactly right. It's anticipatory. But there are many agencies who are very eager to have this technology and to use it for this real-time identification. There, of course, are not many crimes that occur that are recorded by police body cameras. Of course, those are crimes that would be happening within the presence of the officer and in range of the camera in a situation where the officer, of course, is less concerned about the identity of that person than they are apprehending that person. So the identity is quite incidental in these circumstances. The officer's objective in that situation is to prevent or stop the crime or apprehend the suspect, not the identification of the suspect.
All right. I want to thank you both for being with us, gentlemen. That's Kevin Baker, Legislative Director, ACLU of California, Derek Sabatini, Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department Lieutenant, talking with us about his concerns if the bill were to pass that would ban use of facial recognition technology in conjunction with video captured by body-worn cameras by law enforcement officers in the Golden State. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we'll talk about what voters think of candidates for the presidency using Spanish when they address the public. Is that pandering, or hispandering, as some have called it, or a good way for candidates to connect? We'll be back after a live update from Julie Slater. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. For the last few election cycles, we've seen presidential candidates who are multilingual break into Spanish during the course of candidates' debates or in their commercials speak Spanish as a way to try and connect with voters who might be multilingual or even Spanish-only speakers. Sometimes that's praised as showing important consideration, trying to reach members of the community who wouldn't necessarily have English as their first language or be English fluent at all. But others see it as what they call hispandering, that somehow it invokes demeaning attitudes towards people who are not native English speakers. This most recently came up during the first night of the Democratic candidates' debates last Wednesday night, when Beto O'Rourke responded to a moderator question in English and then switched Spanish.
This economy has got to work for everyone. And right now we know that it isn't. And it's going to take all of us coming together to make sure that it does. Necesitamos incluir cada persona en el éxito de esta economía. Pero si queremos hacer eso, necesitamos incluir cada persona en nuestra democracia. Cada votante necesitamos la representación y cada voz necesitamos escuchar.
Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke, that at last Wednesday's Democratic candidates debate. During the first round that same night, U.S. Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey responded to a question about the first thing he would do if elected president.
La situación ahora es inaceptable. Este presidente ha atacado, ha demonizado los inmigrantes. Es inaceptable. Voy a cambiar este. On day one, I will make sure that, number one, we end the ICE policies.
So I'd like to hear from you if you're a bilingual listener to Air Talk, you speak Spanish as well as English, and or you have members of your family who might be Spanish speakers only. What do you think of the candidates using Spanish as a way of trying to connect with Latino voters who might only speak Spanish or might be multilingual? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. There's obviously a generational difference here as well, where younger Latinos likely to be English first speakers or at least learning English very early on. Perhaps older Latinos immigrated to the United States and Spanish would still be the dominant language, perhaps. So there'd be differences there. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page. What do you think of candidates doing this? With me from the California Civic Engagement Project, director and founder of the project, Mindy Romero, political sociologist at USC. Thank you so much, Mindy, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So Latinos are a highly diverse group, as opposed to a block of voters. What's your sense of the mix of responses to candidates speaking Spanish?
Sure. Well, I do think it has been a mix. And certainly, as you said, with some Latinos feeling like it's hispandering or pandering. You know, I think overall, though, I think if you you have to really keep in mind that this is also being broadcast on Telemundo, right? And it was being broadcast to many Latinos that are preferring, at least in terms of their media, to see Spanish language spoken. So I think the candidates were directly appealing to them, to other Latinos as well. There, of course, this is a political strategy in terms of not only just Latinos, period, and recognizing that they're a very huge, important potential voting bloc in the United States, but also we've got the primaries coming up now, early primary here in California on Super Tuesday, and California being almost 30% of the Latino voters, eligible voters in the United States. So that's a critical component of all of this. But I think for many Latinos, many Latino leaders, certainly, we've also heard a lot of positive responses, recognizing that even though it wasn't done perfectly and that matters, still the attempt to engage and the attempt to engage in a way that seems at least sincere, if not perfect, is progress. Latinos get very little outreach and education and or mobilization in any given election, even registered Latino voters. And so to see Spanish at this level is pretty significant. Right? Move forward.
I would think I would like it. I obviously can't put myself in the position of someone who's come from another country and is a Spanish dominant or Spanish only speaker, but it would seem to me that someone would, you know, even if it's not their first language, even if they're not perfect in their word usage or phrasing or pronunciation, the fact that they're attempting to speak to me directly, I would think that would be to their credit, and I would appreciate that.
Yeah, I think that's often the sentiment. Like you said, how it's done matters. The context really matters. I mean, there is a terrible history of political and social marginalization, right, of Latinos in not only in the United States but in California. And so Latinos are very aware of not only not getting that outreach and mobilization, but when they do get it, it often, or at least historically, has not been sincere, or it's been ill-informed or a lot of assumptions made, particularly around language. So I think there could certainly be improvements, but overall, seeing this level, I think is a positive move forward. But really, what would make it better, and I think probably be therefore less up to critique or criticism, would be if we'd heard, more substantive kind of statements that were really drilling down into some of the issues. So what we did hear were kind of more general statements, partial answers, and the rest in English. Again, great to see that. But, not just speaking the language, but really giving substantive answers where possible. I mean, then it shows, right, that level of sincerity, but also making the case that I understand that I, you know, need to show that what my issues are, and that I have a track record of being a champion and being supportive.
Well, that's, of course, a fair critique across the board when it comes to
yes.
to how candidates present themselves, not just in connecting with the broad, diverse Latino electorate. Mindy Romero of this California Civic Engagement Project is with us. We'll take your calls as we continue. I'd like to know, you know, particularly if you are a Spanish speaker, either as your first language or you are multilingual, well, you learn Spanish later. What do you think of the candidates speaking Spanish in campaign ads, in debates, at public events? Do you like it, or do you feel like it's, as some criticized, hispandering? 866-893-KPCC. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about candidates for office speaking Spanish to the electorate, try and connect with Latino voters, and how you feel about that. If you are someone who speaks Spanish, do you appreciate that, even if it's not perfect? Or do you feel like there's a degree of pandering that's involved? Kim in Long Beach says that, I just lost her comment. I was born in Italy but grew up in South and Central America. If candidates are going to make the effort, which I do appreciate, they should probably get their tenses correct. Both O'Rourke and Booker got it wrong. They need someone Spanish-speaking on staff. Katrina writes on the Air Talk page, I'm bilingual. My father is Spanish-speaking only. I think it's laughable when non-Hispanic candidates speak Spanish, especially when they don't speak it well. I feel like it would have been different if Castro would have naturally used Spanish. However, she's talking about Beto O'Rourke. However, in the case of the debate, neither candidate used Spanish to really answer the question that they were asked. That's sort of echoing what Mindy Romero was just talking about. Or was it Julian Castro also? Okay, I guess that's referring to that from the first night's debate. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Let's talk with Sandra in Riverside. You speak Spanish. What did you think of the candidates using it in the debates?
I really loved it, and I appreciated it. I know that there was, you know, a few problems with the correctness of the Spanish, but I felt that the spirit of it was right on. I mean, when else have we seen that? Have we seen that in former debates?
I thought that we had some. I can't tell you who, but I thought in those massive Republican candidates debates that we had some of the candidates who spoke Spanish for brief periods.
Right, and guess what? I am not a Republican, but when I heard them trying, that endeared them a little to my heart.
Yeah, it may have been Marco Rubio, but again, I can't remember specifically. This isn't the first time. I'm pretty confident about that. Sandra, I appreciate it. Thanks for your call, 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Chris in Mid-City, L.A., good to have you with us. What do you think?
All right, thanks for taking my call. I mean, I think if they're struggling, I mean, Beto was clearly struggling. It was forced. I was watching it live with my wife. She's Mexican-American. She started laughing. And I think that if they're not, you know, if they don't know the language, then it's just really not a good look for them. You know, if you listen to Eric Garcetti, he's almost perfect. He's almost perfect. He's made it a point to learn the language. I can only imagine what other people are thinking about this, in particular, like someone like my grandma, who's only a Spanish speaker. It's laughable. It's laughable. And if they don't know it, they should not do it. It's just not a good look for them.
Okay. So, and what is that bar, though, that they need to cross? Is it perfection? Is it, you know, speaking as well as your grandmother, who's a native speaker, would be? Or, I mean, what point do you think that their Spanish is ready for prime time?
I think grammar is most important. I mean, I think naturally, you know, people kind of will accept an accent. But when you're just making grammatical errors left and right, and you're just fumbling over words. Beto was just, it was horrible. And he really has no business doing it. I mean, it's to the point where he shouldn't even be named Beto, because, like, I feel like that's not even, you know, like, it's just not, it just was not a good look. I mean, I laughed at it. I literally laughed at it with my wife.
All right, Chris, I appreciate your call. 866-893-KPECC. Carla, in East Los Angeles, what do you think about the candidate speaking Spanish?
Personally, I'm from the U.S.-Mexico border, so I grew up speaking both languages pretty well. And I do, you know, do a lot of translation work myself. And personally, my problem was that the translation was not directly the same. It wasn't a literal translation. Both candidates spoke in Spanish but did not complete the exact same sentences. So for me, that was the issue. I do really appreciate when they speak Spanish and they try, even if their accent is not perfect. That's not a problem to me. It's just that it sort of seemed like it was two separate messages.
Okay. And do you feel as though there is a pandering element to this, or do you feel that it is respectful, straightforward, and you like that?
I think it's a little bit of pandering because they're not translating directly. It almost seems like they prepared a sentence and memorized it and try to say it exactly how they were told they should say it. It's almost like repeating a part of a song or something. Like, they're not actually being sincere because they're not translating every single part of the sentence, or, you know, to me, that's where the problem is.
All right, Carla, appreciate it. Thanks so much for being with us, hearing from AirTalk listeners, their thoughts about candidates speaking Spanish during public events, television commercials, debates and the like, as we saw Beto O'Rourke and Cory Booker both speak Spanish a week ago at the first of the two nights of the Democratic candidates debates. Joaquin writes on the page, every other country on earth praises an American who tries to speak their language and offers you help. Americans laugh and discourage non-Spanish speakers. Poor grammar. JSK writes on the page, compared to the pandering through advocacy of illegal immigration, it's nothing. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org, and let us know what you think about the candidates using this. Grace writes, as a bilingual, bicultural voter, it was cringeworthy, particularly Booker's comments. I appreciate the attempts, but if it's unintelligible, not so much. That's Grace writing on the page. And again, as Mindy Romero of the California Civic Engagement Project mentioned, this was broadcast by Telemundo, so you did have a Spanish-language American TV outlet, which also made it even more relevant that the candidates would speak Spanish. Stella in Sherman Oaks says, I'm a Spanish teacher. Beto's Spanish is quite good. He made small errors, but nothing was confusing. Cory Booker was ridiculous with his Spanish. It was indecipherable. Anybody who's made the effort to learn has earned the right to use it, in my opinion. That's Stella, Spanish teacher in Sherman Oaks, sharing her point of view. And Mindy Romero, thanks so much. Appreciate you sharing your thoughts about the ways in which the candidates were received for speaking Spanish. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Mindy Romero, again, is the founder and director of the California Civic Engagement Project. She's also political sociologist at the University of Southern California. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up next hour, a look at privacy concerns over companies that collect your DNA and tell you about your ancestry and potential medical problems. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Hope you're having a good day. Great day at the stock market, as you just heard. Another record-setting close on the eve of Independence Day. And speaking of the 4th of July, we'll be off tomorrow for the holiday. Hope you have a really fun one planned. Look like we'll have nice weather. And I'll be back with you Friday for Air Talk and for Film Week coming up 11 o'clock. We'll hear about all the week's movies. We'll also refresh on the films that opened up earlier this week. Full reviews of those on last week's program, but we'll touch on them again so you can catch up. A little bit later, we're scheduled to talk with Daryl Steinberg, mayor of Sacramento, and the homelessness czar for the state of California. But we begin this hour with the booming industry of at-home DNA testing kits. Now, they've skyrocketed in popularity largely for Americans who've wanted to find out about their ancestral roots. And there are a few companies that offer these test-at-home kits, 23andMe, Ancestry.com, and Helix. Some of the companies also offer genetic screening to determine if there is a high likelihood of a particular genetic disease or condition being one that you would be subject to. This, of course, raises privacy concerns. We're aware of law enforcement, for example, being able to use the databases created by these genetic testing companies to solve long dormant investigations. The Grim Sleeper case here in California being a highly prominent one. But what about the ethical issues of using this technology, whether it's for a commercial application by one of the companies collecting the information? What about by law enforcement? What should the rules of the road be for the use of this technology? Joining us is David Agus, who's professor of medicine and biomedical engineering at the University of Southern California, author of numerous books, including The Lucky Years, How to Thrive in the Brave New World of Health. Dr. Agus, good to have you with us again on Air Talk.
Oh, it's a privilege to be here.
So I know this has been a real interest for you, the ethical concerns raised by this. Are there any sorts of ethical guidelines currently in place under which all these companies operate?
Well, I think it's an issue not just for me, but it should be for everybody. And the answer is no. Is that when you sign up for one of these tests, you sign a 15 or 20 page consent form, which, by the way, I can't even read. It's so complex in legalese. And you consent, and then they do the data as in that consent form. We need guidelines. I don't believe in trusting companies, not that they're doing anything wrong, but this is way too complex to put in a 20-page document. We need clear guidelines on what to do here.
One of the points that's been raised is this isn't only about the individual who's paying the money and subscribing to the service, that genetic results obtained apply to other members of the family. So in a sense, if we partake of this, put other family members into the public arena. Can you elaborate?
Well, I think that's the key issue here, right? Is your Facebook page is yours. You control it. But the problem is if you have, say you have a test done to say whether you're at high risk for breast cancer. Well, you go and, you know, listen, I put my DNA results on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. So that implied something about my children, about my parents, about my brothers. So all of a sudden, did I get their consent and I do it or not? If I have a DNA test looking at my ancestry and my cousin commits a crime somewhere in the world, as we saw with the California killer, the police force may be able to identify him. Should I have asked him consent before I did this study? Obviously, he shouldn't have done a crime. But when we look at the privacy issues here, it applies to many people in our extended family, not just ourselves. And that has to do with paternity also, right? When I have a test, I can now see who, if my father really was who my father says he was. Or maybe, you know, we've had many cases, we've been told, where that we have different fathers than we thought. So a lot is happening here. And at the same time, you have companies who are saying, listen, do our test, we'll give you your results, and then we go ahead and sell that data, your genetic data, to a pharmaceutical company. And so it's in the consent that they can do what they want with it, but is that right?
And to me, it's so different than individuals using Facebook, for example, or Google products, because there the deal sort of is you're using the product or the platform for free. And in exchange, the companies find ways of monetizing that. Now, that's controversial in and of itself. What, if any, limits are on that information? But in this case, the customer is paying for a service very directly. It's not, they're not giving you your genetic information, your ancestral tree for free, and then they turn around and sell it as well. So, I mean, it seems like there's also an issue there where the customer, in exchange for paying that fee, should be able to put complete limits on it. Do you think that there's anything wrong with that contention?
Oh,
I agree 100%. Is, you know, again, we're not reading that 20-page disclaimer before we sign up for the test, which says what they could do with it. And then they're taking our information, they're monetizing, and then giving nothing back to us. And so as the consumer, and I think that in itself has issues, is why is somebody making money off my DNA? And by the way, an amazing and elegant science paper came out several years ago where they showed just with my DNA sequence, you know, my 3 billion letters of my DNA code, even if it's anonymized, scientists can figure out who I was. So when they give that information to a pharmaceutical company or whoever they're selling it to, all of a sudden my identity is there too, even though that information was anonymized. There's no way to truly protect it.
We're talking with Dr. David Akis, professor of medicine and biomedical engineering at USC, author of The Lucky Years, How to Thrive in the Brave New World of Health. Back in 2006, he actually co-founded Navigenics, a DNA testing company that used genetic data to help people determine their risk for certain health conditions that might have a genetic basis. That was then sold back in 2012. Also with Judith Darr, a dean of the Chase College of Law at North Kentucky University in Highland Heights, chair of the Ethics Committee of the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. Professor Darr, Dean Darr, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Larry. Thank you.
So what are some of the ways do you think that perhaps governmentally ethical rules could be put in place for how this information is used?
Well, we have to keep in mind that health exceptionalism is already part of the legal fabric governing privacy. We have federal law that is in place that governs the health information that's shared among physicians and generally in the community. And so we already treat it in a very specialized way. In addition, about 10 years ago, Congress enacted a law that deals with genetic privacy, GINA. But the problem with that law and importing it to the situation you're talking about today is that it's rather limited. It applies only to employment situations and health insurance. So we've put our toe in the water with respect to federal law governing genetic privacy. We have a more robust system dealing with health information in general. So there's no reason why we can't carve out and enhance the kind of legal protections that are already in place.
We reached out to Ancestry.com, 23andMe, and Helix to invite them to participate. Ancestry and 23andMe weren't able to provide someone for us during the time of our conversation. We didn't hear back from Helix. If we get a response from any of the three companies beyond that, we will certainly share it with you. Dean Darr, do you think that it is possible for these companies that have formed this sort of lobbying coalition to come up with rules that that are going to protect consumers? I mean, obviously they have a vested interest in getting people to use their service. So can market forces alone be sufficient to have checks and balances for the use of the material?
Well, you asked initially, is it possible? And it's certainly possible, but is the incentive there for them to do it? And we're not seeing that at this point. With the legislation that's being proposed and this lobby group is organizing around, there's very little that they're asking of themselves to move forward and to limit the disclosure that they feel, as Dr. Akis appropriately said, is sufficiently monetized. And I also wanted to, if I may, just follow up on something that Dr. Akis said that's
sure.
really important for our listeners to understand. And it's the tentacles of genetic information. And in our field of reproductive technologies, we have many families that are beautifully and happily formed through donor gametes. And there are now instances in which, for example, a man who agrees to be a sperm donor and wants to be anonymous and did that many years ago is being discovered not through his own DNA, but rather through family members who participate in the Ancestry database. And there are instances in which remote family members are being contacted by donor-conceived persons or their families and wanting to form relationships, and it's a complete surprise to the family that a member was a donor many years ago or perhaps even more recently. So the shock and the impact of the social fabric of that family cannot be overstated.
Do you think that should be banned, that there should not be the ability of family members to have access to be contacted by the offspring of a sperm donor or egg donor?
Well, I mean, that's a somewhat different question. And what we say at ASRM is that those who facilitate donor gamete donation, they can't assure any donor today that they won't be identified by a child in the future. It's just impossible to maintain a completely anonymous system, and nor do I think that's the issue. Just converting it over to the keeper or the database holders, they're the ones who could be put to not sharing that kind of information with those who are trying to discover their own provenance. That's where the controls could come and could realistically have some effect.
Let's take a call from Joe in West Los Angeles. You're on Air Talk.
Hello?
Joe, you there? Go ahead.
Yes, I am. I got caught in the web, which I didn't realize. I had originally signed up for the genetic testing just to look at what my heritage was. And then all of a sudden, I started getting emails about people I'm related to, which is not what I signed up for. And when I contacted them about getting my DNA back, basically, they own it at this point. And they referred me to the website with these two explanatory documents that are 50 pages long each, that basically this is a novelty item, and so you can't get your DNA back. So I asked them to stop doing what they're doing with the DNA, and I don't know how effective that is. So I think that, and I found out through a friend, if you do it through a physician, they can't identify you. And so I'm more worried about the genetics of how this will affect my kids as far as hospitals or insurance companies getting a hold of it. And if I have a condition, which I'm not aware of, that's in that genetic piece of material that they have, that'll come back to haunt me.
Joe, I appreciate your call. Judith Darr, Dean of Northern Kentucky University School of Law. What sort of recourse does a consumer like Joe have?
Yeah, that's such an interesting story. And his experience of not being able to retrieve his information is kind of appalling, but it's obviously what the standard of care is now in the industry. But I do want to assure him, he mentioned concerns about the genetic information being used kind of against him in a medical setting, a hospital setting, and the laws at least address that situation. But his experience is exactly the reason that we need to have a much more robust regulatory system, that a consumer cannot retrieve this kind of private information is really an outrage. And right now, there isn't any legal recourse for that.
We're at 866-893-KPECC. You can also post on the AirTalk page at kpecc.org. USC, Dr. David Akis, Professor of Medicine, Biomedical Engineering. If you had the ability to write the law that would protect the privacy rights, the content of the genetic information that these companies have, what would your bill be?
Well, I think, first of all, everything needs to be opt-in, not opt-out. So you need to be asked the question, do you want your information given to a pharmaceutical company? Do you want your information shared with others so that we can really understand what we're opting in for is number one. Number two is we need education. With discourse comes understanding. And so I think people need to understand no matter how they do it, there are going to be privacy issues here. So as long as one is aware of the privacy issue before they make the decision, like obviously the last caller wasn't, then it's okay. But the key is having that transparency. And we need to educate people around these topics because people are going in blinded. I want to know if I'm from Northern Europe, Southern Europe, and how much Neanderthal I have, so I'm going to do this test, not realizing the impact on themselves and their family members.
All right. And so you would advocate for that. What would be the company's conflicting interest in that?
Well, I think the key thing here is that, and these are good companies. I mean, don't get me wrong. I know nothing negative about these companies, but I don't think we should put the privacy and the regulations in the company's hands. This is where the federal government needs to step in, just like they did with the Non-Discrimination Act, GINA, the Genetic Non-Discrimination Act. They need to step in here and set the guidelines. We all need to be protected. Our country's government steps in to regulate food, to regulate drugs. and to regulate how medical information is shared, they need to have separate and distinct regulations regarding genetics.
We'll continue our conversation with Dr. David Akis, University of Southern California, Judith Darr, Northern Kentucky University's Chase College of Law. We're at 866-893-KPCC. What sorts of privacy protections, consumer information should be available for those undergoing genetic testing to determine ancestry or potential medical problems tied to genetics? You're listening to Where Talk, back in 1 minute. Coming up in just a few minutes, the former Senate President Daryl Steinberg. He's the mayor of Sacramento now, but very importantly, he's named by Governor Newsom as the homelessness czar for the state of California. We'll be talking with him about some of his and his commission's ideas for combating homelessness. The crisis continues to grow, of course, throughout California. Right now, our focus is on privacy rights of consumers who sign up for genetic testing to determine ancestral background or to determine whether they might be vulnerable to particular genetic-linked illnesses. I'd like to hear from you, what your experiences are with this. We're at 866-893-KPECC. The occasion for the conversation is the lobbying group formed by three of these companies that have collectively signed up millions of Americans for the genetic research: Ancestry.com, 23andMe, and Helix. All three of those companies collaborating, lobbying the federal government to try and assure that whatever the rules of the road are for their companies, that it's not going to hinder their ability to do business. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be in the best interest of consumers. 866-893-KPECC. Let's talk with John in Claremont. You're on Air Talk.
Hey, how you doing? My name is John. I have a question for you. It's kind of a hypothetical. Since we don't own our DNA anymore because we give it out and everybody's been giving it out, say in the future the technology of nanites progresses, is it possible that they can eliminate bloodlines? You know, it also depends on the nanite development. Can they possibly delete bloodlines? Because they have our DNA, so they can go in and, you know.
I'm not following. David Akis, do you follow what he's talking about?
No. I mean, we have the ability to edit DNA, and I think that's powerful. It's a technology called CRISPR that came out several years ago, and we've seen two children born in China, and there's another child that will arrive soon with this technology, and we need global governance on it, certainly. But there is no way to eliminate bloodlines, per se. I'm not quite sure.
I don't understand what that's about. Carol Ann in Torrance, you're on Air Talk.
Hi, Larry. I am a 70-year-old genealogist. I was adopted as an infant, and both my certificates have been sealed by the state of California. So as far as the state of California goes, I don't exist. If it weren't for Ancestry and Ancestry.com, I would have no access to my own genealogy.
Yeah. So you'd want to be sure that whatever privacy rules are there wouldn't keep someone like yourself from learning about your ancestry.
No, and be able to share it with my, my mother, my birth mother, who I found, gave me information, but she's dead now, as are both my adopted parents. I want to be able to leave my grandson and his offspring some information about our family, and the state of California has stood in my way since both of my amended and original certificates are sealed in Sacramento.
Judith Darr, you want to respond? Is it possible to serve both privacy interests and those of someone like Carol Ann?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a delicate balance between the parents who do are involved in adoption and the children. And this balance has been struck over time with traditional adoption and now today with gamete donation. And so the question is, how do we go about measuring privacy? And the traditional standard in the law is that privacy is tied to a reasonable expectation on the part of society at any given time. And as we know, we're evolving in our our expectations of privacy. And as we evolve, questions like the one that Carol Ann raises about balancing the rights between parents and children in adoption scenarios are going to probably change and evolve as we move forward.
David Agus, is there much debate taking place on this among governmental organizations, to your viewers? This just sort of been the industry has taken off so fast that there really hasn't been anywhere near commensurate response talking about regulation.
I think there is. I mean, certainly the FDA and the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives have all had hearings on this. And so I think discourse is happening. You know, my hope is it comes to action. You know, technology is changing so quickly in this world. We can't wait for the usual pace of several years of debate to enact new legislation. It has to happen quicker because obviously people's lives and their privacy are at stake today.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Dr. David Agus, University of Southern California, Professor of Medicine and Biomedical Engineering. Thank you so much. And Dean Judith Darr, who heads the Chase College of Law, Northern Kentucky University, our guest joining us yet again. She's also chair of the Ethics Committee of the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming right up, Daryl Steinberg, California's new homelessness czar. Over the years, Daryl Steinberg has been a frequent guest with us on Air Talk as the Senate President pro tem here in California. He's now the mayor of Sacramento. And one of his focal points in his different leadership positions in the state has been concerns about mental illness and how to help Californians who are struggling with mental health challenges. Now, he's been appointed by Governor Gavin Newsom to head a commission looking into answers to the homelessness crisis in the state, which in many cases has very close links with individuals who are struggling with mental illness. With self-medication through substances to which they become addicted, very complex and highly diverse problem that the state faces. Daryl Steinberg, always a pleasure. Thank you for joining us today.
Larry, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor, and I'm proud to serve as a co-chair with Mark Ridley Thomas from Los Angeles. We're co-chairing Governor Newsom's task force together here.
And of course, Mark Ridley Thomas, the Los Angeles County Supervisor, has also taken this up as a significant issue. So as you address this, one of the things I'm struck by is the crisis has grown so quickly that it seems like any sort of a proposal for additional housing units, for supportive services, whatever it is outstripped by just the magnitude of the problem. So what keeps you from getting discouraged that government can even address this?
Well, it's a great question, and it's absolutely true. I mean, if you look at Los Angeles, if you look at Sacramento, if you look at all parts of the state, we're actually getting tens of thousands of people off the streets. The challenge, of course, is that they are replaced by double and triple the numbers of people. And the latest point in time counts in Los Angeles and Sacramento and other parts of the state tell us that while we still have a chronic homeless problem in terms of people who have been out on the streets for a long time, Skid Row and other places, that there's also a significant housing affordability issue here because more people are becoming homeless because of rising rents, because they're living in a very fragile state, housed, and it's so easy, whether it's a broken down car, an unanticipated medical issue, a lost job, to go from fragile and housed to fragile and homeless. And one of the messages here is that we must have a prevention and intervention strategy to prevent more people from becoming homeless. Why am I not discouraged? Because I still believe we can make this better. I never say, and nobody in there could credibly say we're going to cure the problem, but we can make it much better if we have the political will and if we are smart about putting forward the right kinds of investments and strategies.
Does the state have any role when it comes to sweeps of homeless encampments. We have the Idaho court decision, which makes it far more challenging for cities who want to remove homeless residents who are living on the streets. Does the state have any role in that, or is this all up to local jurisdictions to deal with any limits set by Idaho law?
It is not just a local problem. And I want to, you know, commend Gavin Newsom, because he has decided in his first 6 months to put his money, specifically his budget proposal, where his values are, and put forward significant resources for cities and counties to be able to address the shelter crisis and the housing issues as well. But I want to step back here and say something that is common sense and what the courts are telling us. They're telling us that you cannot tell people they can't camp unless you have sufficient shelter. That's essentially it. The converse of that is if we follow through on our commitment to build sufficient shelter, the courts would give us the ability to enforce the anti-camping laws and say to people, you can't live outside. We don't have the moral high ground currently because we don't have sufficient shelter capacity. And one observation that I have that I want to translate into action as we begin this work is that we are so fixated on permanent housing, and understandably so. We need more permanent housing. We acknowledge that it'll take 5 years, 10 years to build sufficient amount of permanent housing, which, by the way, is very expensive to build and subsidize. That we've essentially said, well, we will allow people to live on the streets. We will accept this social condition until we solve the housing crisis. I think we've got to gain some clarity here as a state to say that not only do we need to house people, but we need to perform those triage functions, the case management, and help people with the substance use and mental health problems from the inside. We've got to get people indoors. Indoors. It should be unacceptable to all of us that so many people are living outdoors, and we must shelter people. And not shelter as the end, but shelter as the absolute beginning. And so I want to look at the various jurisdictions around the country that have put a premium on getting people indoors, what it takes, what it costs, what laws are necessary in order to effectuate that, and use the indoors as the place to triage people, not the riverbanks, not the streets, and not the alleyways of cities throughout California. That and a robust prevention and early intervention strategy around helping people who are on that edge, who could advance and increase their tenancies, length of tenancies, if we found a way to step up in the right way.
I want to, when we come back, ask you about ways of better intervening and helping individuals who have recently become homeless. Because when we talk about homeless people, I think what comes to mind is someone who's been unhoused for years, living on the street, very marginal existence. But as we know, a significant percentage of people that are homeless are recently homeless. They're going to be housed again, or run the risk of falling into that chronically homeless population. So what are better interventions we can use early on to help people when they might be in a better position to get a job, to get a house? We'll talk about that with Daryl Steinberg, co-chairing the California Commission on Homelessness, appointed by Governor Gavin Newsom. Back after a live update from Julie Slater. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about the complexity of the homeless crisis that California faces. And with us, one of the people who's been charged with trying to solve the problem, the mayor of Sacramento, Daryl Steinberg, the former president pro tem of the California Senate, and co-chair with L.A. County Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas. of the Homelessness Commission set up by Governor Gavin Newsom. If you have questions for him, there's a great chance for you to have his ear and ask him what you think's important about it. 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. Daryl, one of the things that we talk about a lot is the diversity of the homeless population. We have certain stereotypes that come to mind. But there are a significant number of people who are fairly recent. These are acutely homeless individuals. They're going to end up housed, perhaps, or fall into the chronic homeless category. And I've always wondered, is there more that the state or cities and counties can do to help individuals in the immediacy of their fresh homelessness? And in some cases, that might even mean helping them find jobs in places with lower costs of living, doing what thousands of Californians have done, gone to places like Phoenix, Las Vegas, Portland, other places where it's cheaper to live, getting jobs there. Is there more California can do to help those individuals? Because maybe living long-term in a high-cost-of-living place like coastal California isn't possible.
Well, of course, it wouldn't be right, and we don't have the ability to tell people to leave the state for lower-cost areas. But I do think there are a lot of things we can do for people who've become newly homeless. As part of the recently passed budget, by the state legislature and signed by the governor, local governments will now have at their disposal about $650 million of flexible resources that we can, in fact, use to enhance either the existing federal vouchers or create our own vouchers, if you will, to help people get housed quickly. We call it rapid rehousing, to induce landlords to rent to people who need a place to live. Secondly, we've got more money than we've had ever before, not only the Southern California, the Los Angeles ballot propositions, but the state No Place Like Home initiative, billions of dollars to be able to build more housing. And one of the questions that, again, I want to ask and answer as part of our commission effort is, should we be spending $500,000 a door to build more permanent supportive housing? Because it doesn't take a math wizard to know that with that kind of price per door, you're never going to get to the volume of people who need to be rapidly rehoused and permanently housed for the long term. Third, you're absolutely right. Employment skill training and retraining needs to be an essential piece of what we do for people who find themselves in the worst of situations. And we've established throughout our state these street teams where people who are homeless can earn some money by helping clean up the neighborhoods. But it's got to be much deeper than that, obviously. And finally, we can't ignore the political and ideological and difficult issues of just cause eviction and the rent issues. And, you know, I know David Chu, I commend him, the assemblyman from San Francisco, who's working hard in the legislature to try to put through some rent protection for people. And the balance is, you don't want to create a disincentive to build more supply, obviously. But at the same time, we cannot afford to have more people become homeless. And so there needs to be a reasoned solution, whether they be temporary rent caps, some form of protection for tenants who are getting evicted and ending up as one of the statistics living in their cars or living in shelters or on the street. And so with these new resources, there's a lot we can do to help people who are newly homeless so that they don't end up being the long-term homeless.
JSK writes on the page, back to the question that I asked about assisting people potentially relocating, getting employed elsewhere with a lower cost of living. Not tell, but help people move. Good question that ideologues refuse to acknowledge, but regular people get. And so I do want to come back because it seems like whenever I ask this question of people who are advocates for homeless residents, it's sort of like, well, you can't force people to move. You can. It sort of gets not the question I was asking, which, again, thousands of Californians determined that, you know, I'm going to need to move. It's too expensive to live here. My odds of getting one of these very highly paying jobs that's going to allow me to pay huge rent or buy a house likely isn't going to happen. I'm going to go live in a place with lower cost of living where I can rent or buy something. Are there not ways without pushing people out of the state, but helping people, some people for whom their lives would be improved if they lived in a lower cost of living place elsewhere?
Look, I am not ideological about this, and we ought to be open to any innovative suggestions. If the idea here is to create an incentive pot to help people relocate to lower cost areas of the state or the country, let's consider it. We will look at that. I hadn't heard that idea before, to be honest. And I think that there is no idea not worth considering, given the magnitude of the problem. It goes back to what I mean, to maybe my central point. We have got to change the way we look at this. We need some clarity. There are too many people out on the streets. We need more shelter. There are too many people who can't afford the cost of living. What are we doing to either protect their tenancies or help them find a better and more stable way to live? This commission will look at best practices, no doubt about it, because there are some good practices around. But we're also not going to be afraid to ask some questions that maybe haven't been asked before, including whether or not, once we have sufficient shelter capacity, whether people should be allowed to live on the streets, and whether or not we ought to look at the laws around involuntary question, which has come up in the mental health arena a lot. Very complicated set of laws. But
so you're talking about, for example, the whatever percentage of individual might say, I'd rather pitch my tent in the park than live in this particular facility with a lot of other homeless people who I may not get along with and not want to deal with. I'd rather live by myself in the park. The question is whether, from a civil liberties perspective, people would be free to do that.
I don't believe it's a civil right for anyone to live on the street. But frankly, we as a state do not have the moral high ground because we have not built sufficient capacity, sufficient shelter. By the way, with the intensive substance abuse and mental health services for the people they need them, and with the continuum towards hopefully lower cost efficiency housing, not $500,000 a door, we have not built that system to capacity so that we can say that living on the streets or in the park or on the riverbank is not a civil right. And so it's the combination of seeing this as the public safety and public health emergency that it is, stepping back and gaining some clarity about what it's going to take to actually get people off of the streets, and what are we going to do to prevent people from becoming homeless in the first place. Not easy, but I believe that we can move the needle. There are some things that, you know, are out of government's control here. But yet we do have the responsibility to try to affect the problem. Mayors are on the front lines.
Yeah.
Mayor Garcetti has helped get thousands of people off the streets. So has the County Board of Supervisors. But they need an active partner in the state, and I think they finally have one.
Well, and your city deals with this all the time. I visit Sacramento typically 2-3 times a year, and I stay at a hotel that's on the river there, and I see just on the other side on the banks all the tents that are up and the people that are living along the beautiful Sacramento River. It's a huge challenge your city faces, just like all the other urban centers of California. We'll continue with Daryl Steinberg, Sacramento mayor, head of California's Commission on Homelessness and Supportive Housing, along with Mark Ridley Thomas, LA County Supervisor, back with 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle with The mayor of Sacramento, Daryl Steinberg, former president pro tem of the California Senate, and the co-chair of California's Commission on Homelessness and Supportive Housing. We're at 866-893-KPCC. Michael in Alhambra, I appreciate your patience waiting. Your question, please, for Mayor Steinberg.
Yeah, one problem that I have with these so-called problem solvers is that they never attack the issue. The statistics have not changed for over 20 years. 60% of the people that are homeless are there because of substance abuse problems, drugs and alcohol. 30% have mental health issues, and 10% are people that have fallen on hard times and will bounce right back. So with 60% of the people being homeless because of substance abuse problems, which are drugs or alcohol, why don't you guys never attack that? Because, look, they're going to lose. You can give them a place to stay, but they're going to lose it because of the substance abuse problems. Why don't you guys ever address the root cause of it? You never talk about that. And that's how come the problem persists, because the root cause of the problem is never addressed.
All right, Michael, I appreciate it. Excellent question, Daryl.
Well, let's talk about it. First of all, substance abuse is a serious problem, and methamphetamine especially on our streets. And yes, these are the people who tend to be those that plague the business corridors and the neighborhoods, and who desperately need not just shelter and housing, but they need intensive treatment as well. I disagree, though, about the characterization of the larger problem. The LA point in time count was very clear. The majority of people, the newly homeless, are those who are living on the economic edge and who are fragile. And so this is part of what makes it such a complex problem. The most chronically homeless, long-term homeless, tend to be the people living with the mental health and substance abuse issues. And you're absolutely right. We need to combine the triage shelter, the permanent housing with intensive services. We need more tools on the substance abuse side, absolutely. But it's also a housing problem, and I think we need to see it as such.
C. Shine writes on the page, this discussion is sadly devoid of real ideas. Here's one: make it easier to get real medications. Currently, if you have multiple meds, you have to go back and forth and back and forth to drugstores. I'm bipolar, C. Shine writes. It's taken me 3 years to get my three medications on the same track for pickups. Use Covered California and relaxed laws on prescriptions to make it easier to get your meds consistently. Very, very simple. C. Shine, thank you for the post. Mayor Steinberg, I don't know if you've ever heard anything about that being an issue for people staying on mental health medications.
Well, I sure have. And I wish we had another half hour, because we could talk, and we should talk, about the mental health system in California. And we are working again with the Newsom administration on sort of a separate track here, to look at what it is going to take to fix this system. And, you know, I'm proud of Prop 63. We've got $2.4 billion of public money being infused into the system. It's actually doing great things and helping lots of people. But for most Californians who have a loved one or they themselves live with mental illness, it is still the most difficult system to navigate around medication, around finding a provider, and we don't have nearly enough providers. And making the mental health system better, making it easier to get through the front door, is going to be a key piece of making the homeless problem better, but also helping people who aren't homeless, who suffer too much unnecessarily.
David in Sawtelle says, why can't there be designated areas for homeless Angelenos to set up tents like Veterans Park? Why is that a problem? Are you aware of any California cities that have done that, Mayor Steinberg?
I know some cities in other states have done this, including Seattle, Washington. And it's a question that comes up all of the time. I believe we should be getting people indoors, and I think that needs to be our driving force. And as I said earlier, while permanent supportive housing and fixing the long-term housing problem is the ideal, we can't wait 5 or 10 years before we create the capacity to bring people indoors. Is there a place in the meantime for sanctioned legal outdoor living? We're thinking about that up here in Sacramento, but I'm reluctant because I know the correlation between living outside for a lengthy period of time and bad health outcomes for people is significant and high. I think people should be living indoors with the services they need to reclaim their dignity and reclaim their lives. And maybe it won't be everybody, but it can be more people than we're currently able to help.
One of the things that I hear as a critique pretty consistently from the non-governmental service providers is they feel like they're in the trenches and that they really have a sense of who they're serving and what they're dealing with. And that if they got more public dollars, more resources going to do what they do, that they'd be highly effective, but that they're hamstrung. But instead that the state or county or city, whatever it is, wants to run the thing themselves. And so they have their own people and put their own committees together. So how do you respond to, you know, some of these providers who feel like they're really underutilized and under-resourced so the government could say they're doing it?
I think it is a fair criticism that it takes too long to get money out. For example, on the mental health side, it's been a known problem that some counties have had reserves that are too big and that government in general takes too long to actually get the money out the door. But the money generally goes to the nonprofit community. By and large, city governments and county governments don't actually run the programs. We rely on partnership with the nonprofits. And you're right, they're the heroes because they are actually in the trenches. But we're providing them the resources. They need more to be able to serve more people. And we need to do a better job of getting the money out the door faster.
We have so many questions we don't have time to take up. But Mayor Steinberg, would you be willing to come back in just a few weeks and take more listener questions about this? And there are just so many important issues for us to take up and competing philosophies from the shelter approach to the permanent supportive housing to housing first. I'd like to get into some more of those specifics next time if we could.
I'd be happy to, including the mental health question in more detail if we could.
That'd be good, because I think a lot of us are really unclear the degree of priority that it has in this whole initiative. Mayor Steinberg, thank you as always. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Larry. Bye-bye.
He's mayor of Sacramento and co-chair of California's Commission on Homelessness and Supportive Housing with Mark Ridley Thomas, Daryl Steinberg, joining us on Air Talk. As always, a pleasure to have you with us today. We're off tomorrow for the Independence Day holiday, and I hope you have a wonderful one with your family and friends. I'll be back with you Friday for Air Talk and for Film Week at 11 o'clock here on 89.3. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next. Her guest, Sarah Jessica Parker.